Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present citizen activist and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who assesses the state of the U.S. electoral system as hundreds of millions of anonymous corporate dollars flow to conservative candidates in the 2010 election. Aaron Hughes, organizing team leader with the group Iraq Veterans Against the War, who talks about the absence of debate on the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan during this year's congressional campaign. And Tova Wang, senior democracy fellow with the group Demos, who examines Republican Party allegations of voter fraud and the related intimidation tactics targeting minority voters. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Afghanistan, the CIA has set up a counterinsurgency base near the Pakistan border, dubbed Firebase Lily, to deploy secret paramilitary units against the Taliban. The force of trained Afghans, officially called counterterrorism pursuit teams, are active in hot zones in Pakistan and Afghanistan. According to the Washington Post, the paramilitary force was created to reduce the CIA's reliance on Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency that is seen in many quarters as compromised and too close to the Taliban. The existence of the CIA pursuit teams was disclosed in Bob Woodward's recent book, Obama Wars, and confirmed by field reports from Afghanistan disclosed by WikiLeaks. The military field logs from Afghanistan describe a range of paramilitary operations by the secret teams. These activities include intelligence gathering, the capture of insurgent leaders, and engaging the Taliban in firefights along the Afghan-Pakistan border. The CIA began organizing this secret force soon after the American-led invasion of Afghanistan in late 2001. President Barack Obama rankled free traders when his administration opened a 90-day investigation of illegal trading practices by the People's Republic of China. A petition filed in September by the United Steelworkers of America is now being investigated by U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk to determine if China violated World Trade Organization rules in promoting its clean energy industry. The 5,000-page union petition alleges China illegally promoted its green manufacturing companies by methods that include restricting access to rare earth natural resources, discriminating against foreign firms and goods in Chinese markets, and actively subsidizing its markets in violation of WTO rules. According to the American Prospect magazine, China and free trade advocates linked Obama's trade investigation to election year politics and the need to shore up support among unions. Current opinion polls find that a broad majority of U.S. voters blame job losses on corporate outsourcing and free trade policies. The United States has a long history of large trade deficits in clean energy technology like the manufacturing of wind turbines and photovoltaic solar energy cells. The United Nations Convention on Biodiversity in Japan ended with the approval of new agreements to expand protected regions, as well as a new treaty on sharing the benefits of genetic material important to the development of new medicines. These were a string of major successes. However, the international community has yet to step up with new funding commitments for land and ocean conservation efforts. The meeting stood in stark contrast to the intense despair at last December's climate summit in Copenhagen, when world leaders failed to craft a follow-up treaty to the Kyoto Protocol to set limits on greenhouse gas emissions. Delegates from 193 countries agreed to protect 17% of the globe's land and 10% of oceans by 2020 through the creation of national parks or marine sanctuaries. But there is no enforcement mechanism to back up the resolution and no penalty for noncompliance. At the two-week meeting, Japan announced a $2 billion commitment to fund biodiversity projects in developing countries, which, along with indigenous groups, have long complained about Western drug companies using material found in rainforests to make medicines, but never sharing any of the profits with poor nations. A new treaty now lays out how the benefits of genetic material will be shared between Western pharmaceutical firms and nations supplying natural resources. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon, For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Ever since the 1965 book release of Unsafe at Any Speed, about the U.S. auto industry's reckless disregard for passenger safety, Ralph Nader has been known as a people's lawyer, fighting to protect consumers and the environment from rapacious and greedy corporations. Nader went on to run for president four times, twice with the Green Party in 1996 and 2000, and twice as an independent in 2004 and 2008, where he promoted campaign finance and electoral reforms to strengthen grassroots democracy. Now, in 2010, as the Democrats under President Barack Obama face losing control of Congress as they won in 2006, Nader reflects on the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case that opened the floodgates of unlimited, anonymous corporate contributions to candidates. In the wake of that ruling, all records for contributions in midterm congressional elections have been broken, with most of the money from groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS flowing to conservative Republican Party and Tea Party-backed candidates. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ralph Nader about the problem of unchecked corporate influence in U.S. elections and how citizens can mobilize to challenge our electoral system, where, unlike never before, democracy is for sale.
They opened the floodgates last January in a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court, basically saying corporations can give unlimited money to oppose or support candidates, local, state, national, as long as they're independent expenditures. That is, they're not coordinated with either party. So there is a move now for a constitutional amendment. You can get some information on that by visiting citizen.org, number one. Number two, there's a bill that passed in the House, but it's not passing yet in the Senate, called the Disclose Bill, so that the corporations have to disclose their contributions to these 501c4 so-called front groups that are cropping up with fancy-sounding benign names. Third, the mutual funds, who have the savings of millions of Americans, they own large shares in the pension funds. They own large shares of these corporations, and they can put pressure on these corporations to take the pledge. And the pledge basically say that they'd have to pledge that they are not benefiting from this Supreme Court decision by pumping money into these groups. And if they don't take the pledge, they're suspect. But basically, it's very hard when the Supreme Court rules to change anything short of a constitutional amendment, which itself is very hard. And so the next wave of corporate supremacy will be upon us in the election. And we just have to mobilize people to countervail this. Now, if people feel powerless, let them ask themselves one question. What is it that nobody can stop people from doing? Well, they can't stop people from going to rallies and marches and meeting in living rooms and organizing themselves. They can't stop people from showing up. Look what the Tea Party did, just showing up, although we know it had the support of Fox News, but still, they showed up. And once people show up, they get more of a morale boost. They know they're not alone. They make new friends and acquaintances, and it starts rolling. And I'm saying we only have 535 men and women in the Congress who put their shoes on every day like you and I, and 1,500 corporations who don't have a single vote get their way with the majority of these 535 senators and representatives. And meanwhile, back home, we have the votes and we're not organized. So what we should do is pick a few high support issues and see if 2,000 people in each congressional district, which has 630,000 or so people in them, and organize the Congress watchdog groups with volunteer hours, 200 say a year, and with $200 raised or contributed. That'll open up two offices in each congressional district with two full-time people in each office. Then you're underway. You'll see an amazing change, because there's nothing out there, Scott. There's nothing out there except a few single issue groups. There's nothing out there for the general interest to move the country in another direction. And, you know, 80% of the American people think America is in decline. 75% of Business Week polls say that corporations have too much control over their lives. And 61% in a poll in 2008 said that both major parties are failing. So it isn't like you have to do a lot of persuading, but you have to do a lot of being specific. Because corporations manipulate people against people with generalities and abstractions and ideologies.
Ralph Nader, what role do you think the Obama administration played in terms of reducing the energy of progressive voters out there? At the same time, they heighten the energy of these right-wing guys who are being supported of the beneficiaries of many of the programs that Obama put in place to bail out the big banks and financial institutions on Wall Street.
That's right. Well, first of all, I think Karl Rove put it very well a week ago, imagine the source, when he said, you know, the Democrats have not been able to make their best case. So basically, the Republicans, they're aggressive. They've got their mantra, lower taxes, lower deficits, less government, etc. They keep repeating it at a very general, abstract level. And the Democrats don't say, hey, why don't you come down to where people live and work and see what you mean by all those things? Do you mean conservatives working in Walmart don't want a living wage? They want to work for $8 an hour because of their ideology? And Obama, of course, by his wishy-washiness, by not drawing a sharp line between the Democrats and Republicans, lent a great opportunity for the manipulation and the propaganda that occurred. You know, we have to remember, why did Franklin Delano Roosevelt keep winning handily? It's because he drew a bright line with the Republicans, and it was widely believed that the Republicans were the party of big business, the Democrats were the party of working people. Well, when you don't push for a minimum wage, inflation-adjusted equivalent to what it was in 1968, it would be $10 now an hour, inflation adjusted. The federal minimum wage is 7.25. Obama promised in 2008 to raise it to $9.50 by next year. He hasn't mentioned it. He's never talked about it. He's never allowed his Democrats to have a hearing on it. Well, you know, you're going to lose some people when you do that. When you turn your back on the card checkoff, which he promised again and again to organize labor in 2008, and he's done it again. He's never talked about it. No hearings on the Hill. Well, people start getting upset when he continues the bailout of Wall Street the way Bush did, instead of doing it in a different way, where he helped the victims rather than bolstered the perpetrators, who then resumed their practices and their gigantic bonuses. People get upset. They say, you know, what's going on here? Why should we support these people? When he expands the war in Afghanistan and uses more drones by far than Bush, and says that he thinks he can go anywhere in the world to pursue suspects, regardless of national sovereignties, and he unleashes a huge military budget, well, people say, you know, what do we vote for here? So what hurt the Democrats is people not voting, is people staying home, the way they did in 1994 and gave Gingrich his victory.
That was citizen activist and former Green Party and independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Nader's latest book and first novel is titled Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. Read his articles online at nader.org. Conspicuously absent from all the debates and political advertisements inundating the airwaves before the November 2, 2010 congressional midterm election was any discussion about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan from any perspective. Suicide bombings and massacres are continuing in Iraq, overwhelmingly affecting civilians, while the Iraqi government has been deadlocked since elections this past March. The number of Americans dying in Iraq has dropped sharply, while in Afghanistan, 2010 has been by far the deadliest year of the 9-year-old conflict, with 413 Americans killed so far. Yet, neither incumbents nor their challengers were talking about the wars, and the media have almost universally ignored the issue during the 2010 campaign. Aaron Hughes, organizing team leader with Iraq Veterans Against the War, served in the Illinois National Guard from 2002 to 2006 and was deployed to Iraq for 15 months in 2003 to 2004, driving a supply truck. His original 6-month tour of duty was extended 3 times. After returning to the U.S., Hughes joined Iraq Veterans Against the War, which now has 2,000 members, including a growing number of vets from the Afghan War. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hughes about the phenomenon of political and media war amnesia in this year's election and its implications.
I recently watched The Daily Show, and the president was on The Daily Show just the other day, and he came on and he talked about why he won the election. And he brought up all these different types of reform, like health care reform. And during that little segment, he did not mention the fact that he won or had ran on an anti-war platform. And he didn't once bring up the war, nor did John Stewart. And, you know, on a really personal level, I just found it just insulting or dismissive. I mean, I understand that he has political points and he's in the middle of a majorly contested election where the Democrats are trying to hold on to seats. And, you know, I understand all of those politics, but to not even acknowledge these wars are going on, it doesn't seem to acknowledge the sacrifices and the loss that's been going on. You know, the repression of these issues, I think, is why the suicide rate is so high and why the self-destruction of veterans on their return is so high, because no one is acknowledging these wars. You know, outside of people's political perspectives on the wars, the fact that people aren't even acknowledging that they're taking place and that people are losing their lives and having to kill people, it's just a disgrace. I think it's really saddening to me. You know, one of IVAW's main positions, Iraq Veterans Against the War, right now is we just launched a campaign called Operation Recovery, Stop the Deployment of Traumatized Troops. Because right now, a bare minimum of 20% of the soldiers, according to the DOD's own statistics, are already diagnosed with PTSD or military sexual trauma or traumatic brain injury. And they're being redeployed and redeployed and redeployed. And they're being redeployed because the military's numbers are so low that they keep having to rely on the same number of soldiers to fight these occupations. And my perspective is, if this country isn't behind these wars, why are we keep sending these young men and women off to fight them?
Have you seen any response yet to your campaign by any branch of government?
At our campaign announcement on October 7th, the anniversary of the Afghanistan invasion, our campaign was brought up at the White House briefing, and the response was to refer to the Department of Defense regulations. And according to the Department of Defense own regulations, they are violating those regulations. And we know that we're in an uphill battle to enforce these regulations, but the fact that no one in Congress or Senate is actively trying to enforce the Department of Defense to hold up to their own regulations.
Aaron Hughes, why do you think no politicians are talking about the wars?
When the wars are so unpopular publicly that there's not a right answer for a politician to take. And so it becomes a political discourse. It's one where what they're saying, no matter what they say about the war, it's not going to improve their ratings. Whether they say that they believe in the war, whether they say they don't believe in the war, or whether they talk about the complexities of the war, no matter what, acknowledging the war is not going to help them win the election in any direction, especially with over 70%, somewhat of 70% of the population not believing, not agreeing with these wars. So I just think it's a politically problematic thing for politicians to be bringing up if they are trying to win an election.
What will Iraq Veterans Against the War be doing after the election? Will you continue focusing on your Operation Recovery project or other things?
We have a multiplicity of projects that we are working on, but our focus as an organization right now is Operation Recovery. And we're focusing on this because we just find it to be the most egregious act of the military to continuously redeploy these troops that it knows and is aware of that they have already been diagnosed with these conditions. And the fact that they give them prescription drugs and redeploy them, I think, is extremely problematic. And we're working in that practice. I don't know anybody that can say they're for the deployment of traumatized troops, and we're hoping to end that practice. So that's our focus. But we also do work around truth and recruiting, trying to inform youth about the realities of serving within the military. And we also do solidarity projects. We work with U.S. Labor Against the War to support Iraqi union working rights.
Is there anything you want to add about this situation where wars are being ignored, basically?
I think this just shows us as individuals that aren't necessarily a part of the political system, that we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of coming together and raising our voices about this issue, because if we don't force the politicians to take on the war, these wars are just going to drag on, and we're going to force more and more service members to lose their lives. And the question is, what for?
That was Aaron Hughes of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Contact the group by calling area code 217-898-9083 or visit their website at ivaw.org. Claims of voter fraud have been a familiar refrain from Republican Party officials in recent elections. In 2010, as in past years, the GOP has charged that Democratic allied groups have systematically worked to allow non-citizens to vote or permit Democratic supporters to cast multiple ballots. When reports indicated that the number of Democrats voting in early balloting was higher than predicted, Dick Armey, who leads the Tea Party movement's patron group, FreedomWorks, explained to Fox News that the higher number of Democrats voting was due to voter fraud, all said without a shred of evidence. The reality is the high-pitched charges of widespread voter fraud are blatantly false. From October 2002 to September 2005, the Justice Department charged only 95 people nationwide with election fraud. 55 were convicted, with less than 20 convicted of casting illegal ballots. Instead, Republicans have used these dubious charges of voter fraud as a justification to employ the tactic of voter intimidation at polling places around the country, specifically targeting minority communities. As voting got underway in 2010, examples of this tactic emerged in Texas, where poll watchers, with ties to a Houston Tea Party group called True the Vote, were reported to have interfered with minority voters' right to cast ballots. Another Tea Party-linked group in Minnesota offered a $500 bounty to anyone providing tips about voter fraud. Elsewhere, flyers and robocalls deliberately misled Black and Latino voters about the date of the election or the documents required to vote. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tova Wang, senior democracy fellow at the group Demos, who examines bogus claims of voter fraud and the real danger to democracy of unchallenged intimidation tactics targeting minority voters.
You have certain politicians and political groups and activists who run around screaming that voter fraud is, quote, an epidemic and, pervasive throughout the system, including in-person voter fraud at the polling place, which people must vigilantly guard against. And it's just an absolute canard. It's just not true. The number of cases of polling place voter fraud are incredibly low. I mean, it's, you know, one thing that we all like to talk about in the voting rights world is how you have a better chance of getting hit by lightning than seeing an actual act of voter fraud committed to the polling place. That's how rare it is. And so this kind of thing is ginned up every election year, and what you have is then, you know, people really having their faith in the system undermined and believing that the system is rigged against them, and it's really unhealthy for democracy. And it's really to sort of get the groups out there and doing these sort of voter fraud watch activities that then turn into really voter intimidation activities. And it's to enact policies such as, you know, voter ID laws and you know, proof of citizenship in order to register to vote laws that make it more difficult for perfectly eligible voters to take part in our democracy.
Tell us a bit about the details of some of the intimidation tactics that the Republican Party and their allies have been practicing at the polling places in previous years in terms of poll watchers with video cameras and otherwise challenging verbally various voters, particularly targeting minority communities.
Well, we have been seeing since at least the late 50s, actually it all started with former Chief Justice Rehnquist in Arizona, this practice of challenging voters, and particularly in minority polling places, as to their eligibility to be voting or saying that they, you know, back in those days, having them take some kind of reading test. But even, you know, over the last many years, we see voter challenges at the polls based on very flimsy to no evidence of lack of eligibility in minority polling places in particular. And I have been concerned, frankly, over the last year that the Tea Party movement, with, you know, the level of anger and mistrust that they have in government and systems, would find its way into the polling place. And that's exactly what's already happening, particularly in Texas, where they have a pretty lengthy early voting period. Tea Party groups have gotten together and have already allegedly been going to polling sites in predominantly minority neighborhoods, especially in the Houston area, and interfering with people's votes, confronting them, following them. Other groups around the country, I would say probably in about a dozen states, are encouraging members to sign up to be poll watchers and then encouraging them to do things that are right out of the classic playbook of voter intimidation throughout the years, such as you mentioned, photographing people at the polls, following them around, videotaping them, that sort of activity, which done in a very neutral way could be legal, but if it intimidates people at all, it's not legal. And I'm not sure even all these people who are engaging in this kind of activity even realize that. They're sort of being encouraged to do this by people who should know better, but they may not know the rules and where the lines should be drawn.
Well, looking to the future, what can be done to rein in this kind of abhorrent anti-democratic activity, either at the local level with citizens organizing or in our legal system, to really hold to account people who engage in this kind of awful activity?
The laws are very weak. I mean, I have written about challenge laws in particular a great deal, and the need to strengthen state challenge laws so that it is more difficult to challenge a voter at the polling place. That if you're going to have individual citizens challenge other voters, which I don't think is a great idea in the first place, but make it clear that they have to have actual evidence that the person is not an eligible voter, you know, either some kind of firsthand knowledge or documentary evidence. And in light of what's been going on this year, I think we're really going to have to do a review of our poll watcher laws. You know, we need to think about maybe limiting the number of poll watchers that are allowed to go to a single polling site, because one of the things we saw in Houston in the last couple of weeks is, you know, sort of like these hordes of poll watchers, frankly mostly white, going into black communities and, you know, sort of surrounding the place, which in itself is, you know, not an ideal way to have the voting process work. And make really clear the rules for what poll watchers are and are not allowed to do. I think that we really need to take a look at our laws for some more clarity on that issue.
That was Tova Wang, Senior Democracy Fellow at the group Demos. Contact Demos by calling area code 212-633-1405 or visit their website at demos.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tak. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.